This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Some of Jocelyn Casanova's earliest memories are of trying to adapt to her kindergarten classroom. Everyone there spoke English, while her parents spoke only Spanish. But Jocelyn excelled in school and had dreams of going to college and becoming a lawyer. Then Jocelyn learned from a college interviewer that she was not a documented American, as she thought she was. Jocelyn's family had brought her to the U.S. from Mexico when she was a toddler, and they never talked about her status. So suddenly, as a high school senior, the identity and opportunities that she always assumed were hers were thrown into question. It's estimated that well over a million people living in this country were brought here and raised without documentation, and many, like Jocelyn, had no idea of their own history. And with Donald Trump's decision to rescind the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, these young people are facing even more uncertainty. Jocelyn Casanova is a college student at Wake Technical Community College and an outreach coordinator at Uniting NC, and she joins me today. Jocelyn, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Tell us more about your earliest memories here in the U.S. and kind of what you remember growing up.
The one memory that definitely stands out, as you mentioned, was kindergarten. The first day I came to kindergarten, I came to a place where no one understood me. Obviously, I could speak, but they didn't understand what I was saying. So that was kind of difficult, adapting to the classroom. Even trying to go to the bathroom was difficult. I found myself crying because no one understood what I was saying and looked at me like I was insane.
Where were you? Where in North Carolina?
Here in Raleigh.
Yeah. So you're doing that. What about that? What did you take away from that? Because ultimately, we're going to talk about you becoming a very determined student. When did that set in, your idea that you're going to do well in school?
The idea of doing well in school would mainly came from my parents, especially my mom, Maria. She's always been there for me. I remember in kindergarten at home, she would do her very best to teach me Spanish. Like, she would stay up late making me learn, rewrite Spanish. And with my homework, it was difficult as well because I didn't know the language, but she did her very best. So she would stay up till midnight or 1 a.m. looking through Webster's Dictionary and translating.
Was she helping you learn English?
She was helping me with my homework.
With your homework.
Yeah.
But she didn't know English, and yet she was so she would have to sort of do the best she could to understand English.
Yes.
To get you through your homework.
Yeah.
So she's got a dictionary in one hand and your homework in another, mm-hmm. and she's getting you through it. Do you have any memories, or did you then, because I think we're going to talk about the fact that some memories had come back to you, but at that point, had you remembered anything about Mexico?
Not really. I was a toddler, so at the time, I guess my memory wasn't really developed yet, so I didn't think anything of it. Just thought of a new place, new people, but nothing of it.
And as you got older, you started doing pretty well in school, right?
Yes, definitely. I always made sure that regardless of like what grade level I was, I'd always like make sure to have time to help the community or do extracurricular activities.
What about the you talked about your mother's sort of being willing to pick up a dictionary and go help you with your homework. She also got involved in school, which is a very difficult thing for people to do. Even as a kid, it's one thing to be thrown in among other kids. But for an adult to be put in an environment where you're a non-English speaker, that's pretty challenging. And yet your mom did that, huh?
Yeah, she's an inspiring woman, inspirational. She always made a point to my professors that, you know, if there was always an issue with me or, like, they needed to have a conference with her or something, that she would always be there regardless of, like, the language barrier. And that always amazed me. Like, I knew that her and my dad always stood out in school whenever they had, like, those those adult parenting meetings.
You're right, PTA meetings.
PTA yeah. meetings or, you know, just events at the school, they would always make sure to be there for me, regardless if they understood or not. So they were always there providing their support, and I really appreciate that from them.
Understood that she even spent a lot of time figuring out a way to write a note in English for you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There was a time that I think something happened at school, and she wanted to know from the teachers, and she took the time again with her dictionary and wrote out a letter in English, even though, you know, she didn't understand the language. So she always made sure that she was present.
So tell us about then when you found out that you were undocumented. What was happening with you at the time?
So at the time that this happened, it was a few days before graduation, high school senior year. Probably not the ideal time to find out because at this time, you know, we're prepping for college. I'm making plans with some of my classmates, like looking for roommates. So I had all this planned out with my friends that we're going to be roommates and do all this stuff in school together.
Where were you going to go?
I was going to go to...
Did you want to go? Yeah.
I want to go to Campbell.
Campbell, okay.
But again, that was like the school that did the red flag and told me that, you know, showed me that I was undocumented.
Tell us how that happened.
So I went to Wakefield High School, and at this school, at the time, they had interviews on site where you could interview with the college, and if they looked at your resume and portfolio, you know, they would like accept you on the spot. So I, of course, submitted an application because I want to be a lawyer, and they have a really good law program. So I applied, and the interview was telling me, oh, you were really great. Like, we love you. You have all these great qualifications. And then they told me, they're like, but there's one thing. Your immigration status isn't showing. And I'm confused. I'm like, what do you mean? And they said, well, it's missing. So you either file that or you just leave it like that. And I called my mom, and she said that she didn't have any of the paperwork. And I told them, and they said, we're sorry, we can't take people like you. And that was very confusing because I thought that I did really well in school. Like, I thought I had all the qualifications to go, and then they told me that I can't. So,
I mean, it's interesting. What about your school? Because it would seem to me that as you're making all these plans, you're telling your counselors and other people, I mean, have they raised this question for you?
No, they haven't. At the time when I did find out, I went to my counselors shortly after. I'm like, what are my options? Because I still wanted to go to college regardless if I had the status or not. But they said that they didn't have any answers for me. So I had to, I guess, try to find an alternative path for myself.
Had you ever considered this? I mean, your parents did not speak English. Did you knew that they had come from Mexico, that they had come
yeah,
from Mexico.
Yeah, I knew.
They weren't born here. Had that those thoughts ever sort of, because they hadn't talked about it. Clearly, they didn't talk about it at home.
Not really. It didn't ever occur to me. I mean, yeah, the language barrier, and I knew that they were different in a way, but I never thought that of an issue, just because of the way that they, my upbringing. You know, we celebrated all the holidays from here, 4th of July, Valentine's Day, all the American holidays, so I grew up with the customs from here, and that's all I know. So it just never occurred to me.
What was that conversation like at home when you did talk about, you know, the fact that your status now changed things for you?
It was a little difficult and awkward. It's not something that you can just tell someone, you know, being here over 17 years of your life and then saying you're actually not from here. So it was a little awkward for my mom, and she was kind of like beating around the bush, trying to find a positive spin to it. But she just told me that I was born in Veracruz, Mexico, and that I'm not actually from here.
What did you do next? What was going on in your mind?
I had mixed feelings. I was confused. It's just the timing was just really bad because it was like literally a few days before I was going to walk on stage for graduation. So I wasn't sure who I was supposed to tell or like what to do next, because like my plan was to go to college. And now like that wasn't a possibility for me.
And of course, part of that would have been applying for grants and aid and all of those things that are available to citizens. And obviously that's off limits.
Yeah,
as well.
Definitely.
So now tell us more about your life in Mexico and whether any of that then, you know, sort of pieces of memories began to come back that you could now put in context.
Yeah. So when she told me, probably at that instant or a few days later, a lot of memories had come back, mainly not so much of like Mexico because I was really young, but like getting here, I would have nightmares growing up, and I never understood what they were, where they were from, and I never thought anything of them until that day that I realized, oh, that's probably what that is. That makes sense.
What kind of images? What were you seeing in
the
street?
The images I was getting at night were like me waking up really sweaty and like getting lost in a desert, feeling dehydrated, feeling scared, not being able to see anybody or not my mom. It was just very traumatizing.
Did you, and these were kind of recurring dreams?
Yeah, they were.
Were you, later did you find out the story and how much of what you remembered in these dreams was actually what was happening?
Yeah, so later they told me exactly what happened and how is it that I got here. And so we crossed the desert. It was extremely hot. I got separated by my mom because of, like, immigration came. And I was with my uncle at the time. And
that, forgive me for interrupting, yeah. but that must have been an awful moment for your mother.
Oh, yes. She was distraught. Like, the look on her face, I still can't forget it, of horror, of terror, like, getting separated from your child. And at that time, I didn't see her for what felt to me in toddler for years, because I was just a child. The actual time was probably a few months, but, like, at that time, it just felt like years. And after that, I felt that they took me to a house with a bunch of random people, and it smelled awful. The conditions were horrible. People were, like, telling me that, oh, you need to be quiet, because I would be crying at night, you know, crying for my mom and hoping that she would come get me. And they would tell me that this man's going to come get me, and I was just scared the whole time. It was a really bad experience.
Was anybody, I mean, you talked about, you mentioned an uncle at some point. Was he still there, and was this somebody that you had known?
Yeah, he was my dad's uncle, so he was my uncle. Yeah, he was there, but he wasn't in the same room as me, and he was separate, and he was much older, so he wasn't really there for me.
So what about food and accommodations? I mean, was there, you see a lot of people in this room? Were there beds? Was there food?
We would sleep on the floor, and I think there was very limited food. I don't remember that much, but yeah, it smelled really bad, and the conditions were really horrible.
So what happened next? How did you then become reunited with your parents?
So after that, I think I continued with the journey. I tried again, and I made it to North Carolina. I remember walking into the apartment door where my parents were, and a bunch of random people were there, I guess, like their friends that they had made, and people that they told that we were separated, and they were all cheering and happy, but I was still confused because still I was four, and I was dehydrated, malnourished. I smelled awful. Like, I really needed a bath. So they rushed me to the hospital because I was dying.
Yeah, dehydration. And at that age, with all of the other problems that you might have had, how much of this is your memory and how much of this is what you were told about your journey?
Most of it is pretty accurate. All the dreams I've had and what I've asked my mom and what she's told me is basically the things that I've remembered. Most of it I felt like I've blocked off because, like, it's just something that you don't want to remember. It's like a bad experience.
What was that like for you? Again, so we're imagining here that you had, these are memories that came back to you at a certain point. Did they start coming back to you once you were told, or had you had fragments of, I mean, beyond the dreams?
Yeah.
You talked about the dreams, but were there moments when you would sort of have a memory that you couldn't put in context, so you sort of dismiss it and then?
Yeah, definitely. Like, walking the desert is probably the one that I would dream about or see, and I'm just confused because, like, I've never been to the desert. Yeah. So I wasn't sure what that memory is about, but I just dismissed it because I thought, oh, maybe I'm just daydreaming about something.
So then all of a sudden all these images and dreams and memories make sense for you.
Yes, definitely.
All at once. So you can imagine this flood of images that now get put into context, and a future that you had worked out for about, 15 or so years by the age of 17. And now that's all upended. What did you do next? You graduated, and then what was that summer like for you?
That summer was really hard for me. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do. I was really depressed for a couple of months because I saw all my friends going off to college and at these parties or, like, you know, just being, well, doing the American thing, going to college. And that's what I wanted to do for my parents and for myself. But then, like, shortly after, a few months, DACA came about, and that gave me a sense of hope. So when DACA came, I went to work, and that's all I did for a good year because going to college is still difficult because of DACA. I have to receive out-of-state tuition. So going to community college for me is about $5,000. For a regular resident, it's about $1,000 to $2,000, and I can't even imagine how much it would be for a four-year college.
Yeah, and you're not, and even under DACA, I don't think you're eligible for any kind of aid.
No, I'm not.
Or loans. So this doesn't confer any kind of citizenship or any of the benefits of citizenship apart from being allowed to do certain things without being deported.
Yes, definitely.
And it's what and we take identity for granted. I wake up and I know who I am and I'm the same guy I've been for 65 years, but I wonder what it does to a 17-year-old who thought they were somebody, an American, mm-hmm. and has, as you say, participated in all the things that make you American, and then find out that you're not. Does that change how you think about yourself?
Yeah, I felt that I wasn't good enough at that point because I wasn't sure who I was. I thought I was from here, and then they tell me that I'm actually from here. I'm from somewhere else, and it was just a very confusing time, especially at that age.
And it's also, again, if you're an American citizen and you fill out the paperwork, check a couple of boxes and it gets easy. What's the application process like? What's the application process like for DACA, just to be eligible for that?
So for DACA, I believe you have to be at least 16 years of age and had arrived before 2012.
But in terms of doing the paperwork, I mean, yeah. What was that like?
Is that doing the paperwork process? Was not a simple process. You have to provide all kinds of proofs that you've been here before that time. So provide like your school records, your transcripts, hospital records, any kind of achievements that you've done. It's just a lot of things that you have to submit and get copies of.
Did you have help doing this the first time?
Yeah, I went to a workshop. A local charity had a workshop. I think it was Catholic Charities, and I went there and filed.
And then you, what about applying for college? Is that any different given your status or as a DACA?
Applying for college is the same thing. I believe that you have to submit like the card of employment and that saying that you're allowed to be here.
And for you, I think the process too, I mean, I think you had everything kind of all set up and then your car broke down, right? You ended up with you were just about ready to go and there was this new mishap.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. It felt like one thing after another, but at the same time, I'm grateful for all the difficult times that I passed because I learned from those mistakes.
Well, tell us more. Tell us that story.
So there was this time where I was getting ready to go to college, but my car broke down, unfortunately. So I had no way of going to class, and I had already paid for it because for DACA, you have to pay up front. And I wasn't sure how I was going to get there, and I had used up all my savings to pay for books and tuition. So I don't know. Somehow I managed to still go, whether it was walking, taking the bus, hitching rides from all my friends. Like, I still pushed through and got there.
This is all exhausting. Were there any moments when you said, look, this is just not worth it, I'm going to quit?
Yeah, there's times where I wake up and I'm like, seriously, is this worth it? But at the same time, if I don't do it for myself, who will?
What makes it worth it for you? What if you went back to Mexico, for instance?
I don't want to go back. I think what makes it worth it is being that sense of hope for your family that you would be able to provide for them. And I feel safer here in America than I would be feeling in Mexico.
We'll talk a little bit about why your parents left and more about your future when my conversation with Jocelyn Casanova continues. She's a dreamer who grew up in Raleigh without knowing she was undocumented. We'll hear how she rebounded and what's going on with her now on the State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Jocelyn Casanova, college student and outreach coordinator at Uniting NC. She was brought here by her parents from Mexico as a toddler, grew up unaware of her undocumented status. When the truth was revealed at a college interview, she was suddenly forced to reconsider her future. And we talked about the fact, Jocelyn, that you then became eligible for and, in fact, a DACA recipient. Tell us about how that changed things for you and what you were able to do for your family as a DACA recipient.
As a DACA recipient, I'm allowed to work and go to college, so I was able to help pay for some of the bills at the house, get cars. You know, it opened a lot of doors and be able to go to government facilities without feeling scared.
Drive your sister around a little bit?
Oh, yes, definitely. Jaleesa.
She was born here, right?
Yeah, she was.
So we'll talk more about that. We talked about the application process. It's also a little bit expensive as well, right? I mean, you ended up losing or eating up a lot of your savings just trying to get all of this paperwork done, right?
Yeah, it's very expensive. Even taxes, like paying taxes every year, it's very expensive. Mm-hmm. I feel like our rate is a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. That could be wrong, but going to school, insurance, applying for DACA, it all adds up.
So you're doing that now. Tell us about what you're studying in school.
Right now I'm studying at Wake Tech Community College. I'm doing a business administration major in marketing, but I want to become a lawyer. So that's my real goal.
What about how do you think business administration is going to help you there? I mean, obviously it's good to get 2 years under your belt. That's great. Do you imagine that the law that you're going to practice is going to be kind of business law? Is that part of the idea?
Not really. I want to definitely do immigration law, yeah, again, because I want to help other people in my situation. But I feel like business could help me with law by owning my own business. Hopefully one day I can own my own law firm. That's an ambitious goal, but I really hope to do that someday.
But, you know, as you move up the income level, you're going to be paying more of those taxes. And that's something. You're already paying taxes now. I think this is something that I'm being facetious at the moment, but I'm doing this to make a point. You're paying taxes, and that the more people earn, the more taxes they pay and the more infrastructure they support. So this is something that I think we simply have to keep in mind, that by encouraging people to get an education and get a job and own their own businesses, we're also encouraging people to contribute more to their community. You've applied for DACA, then you got in and got it. You're in school now at Wake Tech and got involved in something called Code the Dream. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so while I was working and going to school, I ran into Code the Dream. And Code the Dream is an alternative path for those who can't afford college or have DACA like myself. Basically, it's a free coding program that teaches people how to code. It could be different languages like Ruby or Java, and it's a 12-week course where students go to a class and learn from a local coder in the area.
That's pretty good. What do you do with that?
So whatever you learn, we try to help people find a career in coding. So, for example, like myself or my family, we were never exposed to coding or technology, and that path or career path just didn't seem likely for us. But having an organization like Code the Dream, allowing students to get a feel for it, really helps with that gap.
You're also, it seems to me, networking with other students who are pretty much in your situation. What's it like to be within that community?
I think it's great. I love being able to share my story with other people and being with people that are like myself. I feel like I'm not alone, and I love having that support from them and saying that we're all in this together.
You are an outreach coordinator with Uniting NC. Tell us about Uniting NC and what your job is.
Yeah, Uniting NC is a nonprofit organization started in 2009. We aim to make North Carolina a more welcoming home. We help people in different ways. So whether it may be by hosting events and inviting local people to meet a new immigrant in town, or, helping in other ways like the coding program and things like that.
You talked about feeling safer here than you might in Veracruz, Mexico, mm-hmm. An unsafe environment, part of the reason that your parents have come to this country. And, of course, we know a number of immigrants and refugees are fleeing violence in their own countries. Given the fact that we've heard, what we hear from the White House about immigrants, the idea of putting up a wall between us and them, a very clear sense of separation about other people from other countries, do you still feel safe in this country?
Regardless of what's going on right now, I still feel a lot safer than I would feel back home. Like, I could walk the streets and feel safe, but over there I feel like I could be snatched up or be taken from the cartel just because I'm walking or I look pretty or just for no reason.
Well, tell us more about what's going on there and why this would be a fear in Veracruz.
Yeah. So in Veracruz or in Mexico in general, yeah, there's a war between cartels, and they don't mind taking people's lives just because they feel like it, or if you don't pay your quota because you're living in their territory, they'll take your life just because. And even if you try to, seek for government help or something, sometimes the government is in on it. So it's like you don't know who to turn to or who to trust, and you just don't feel safe at all.
What is the response to the president's decision to rescind DACA? Again, you're sort of very active in these communities. What are you hearing from people?
People are sad because obviously it's not something you can take lightly, saying that a program that's allowing you to be here is being taken away from you. It's kind of saying, like you said before, waking up, knowing who you are, but then saying, oh, well, because I know who you are, I think you can't be here anymore. It's just not something that you can take lightly. And a lot of people are, you know, trying to share their story, like myself, and we're trying to provide a better future for our family. We're trying to give back to this country that has given us so much. We love this country. We love America.
You said that you, you know, you're paying taxes. It's about $5,000 a year, I think. Is that right? In tuition?
Yes.
At Wake. So that's quite an investment that you're making. DACA, you know, there's some uncertainty about the future of the program. But at the moment, you know, it's slated for an end. This is quite an investment. Aren't you worried that you may be sent home when all this is said and done?
Yes, definitely. I'm definitely worried because...
And forgive me for saying sent home. This is your home, but you may be sent back to Mexico.
Yeah. I'm worried because, you know, all of those long hours that I put at work, you know, working two jobs, just trying to go to school or working full time, just it's going to go to waste. The sacrifice that my parents made to bring me here, crossing the desert just to bring me here to feel safe and have like a stable future, is going to go to waste. And I feel very upset that that's going to be taken away from me. I know a lot of people say that there's a right way to do it, but there's not a line over there that you can jump in, especially if you're poor. I come from a very poor family, and we just didn't meet the qualifications to do it. So of course, maybe we did it in the wrong way, but if we would have stayed over there, I wouldn't be here before you today.
We talked about this and, you know, the right way to do it and the wrong way to do it. And you just heard my slip of language. It's so easy to kind of fall into some of these lapses, misuse of language. One of the things that I know that concerns you is the way we talk about DACA recipients. And very often you'll hear defenders of the program say, well, it wasn't their fault. After all, they were too young when they were brought here by their parents. But you have some thoughts about that kind of language as well.
Yeah. I know people say that they blame our parents for bringing us here and it's their fault. But I don't blame my parents. I'm very grateful for my mom, Maria, and my dad, Jorge, for bringing me here. They took that risk of bringing me here because they knew that if we would have stayed over there, then I probably wouldn't be here. It's just a reality. And the media doesn't show you that kind of thing. So I don't blame them for doing the right thing. I'm grateful for them for providing an opportunity or a better future for myself.
You recently shared your story for the first time in class. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it was funny because I was running late to class and I walked into my HR college class and the teacher wrote DACA on the board. And I thought that was kind of odd because usually I don't expect college teachers to talk about political things like that. So she read an article about DACA and what it was. And she was like advocating for DACA recipients and that they're doctors, lawyers, and all that. And I told her, I was like, hey, well, I'm going to be speaking about the issue at WUNC on Monday, if you want to listen. And then she realized that I was a DACA recipient, and she was taken aback because I've had her for just about every semester that I've been in school, and I've never said anything about it. It's just not something that you share so easily because I feel like people judge you. Mm-hmm. So then she told me if I could share my story before the class, and there I was sharing my story before all my peers and just letting them know that my situation, and hopefully, you know, they still like me, but it's just the reality of things.
You broke the embargo. You talked to your class before you had told the story on WUNC, but we'll forgive you for that. what was that like for you? Because you say you haven't really shared it easily with other people. Was it difficult for you to sort of start that story in front of these classmates who you assume didn't know?
Yeah, it was very difficult because I see these students like every other day, and I just didn't want them to look at me differently. You know, I usually tried my best to blend in. But it was just something that was really difficult for me to share to them because I felt like I was being judged just for being here. But, you know, I want to be there just as much as they do.
What was the reaction?
They clapped, and I remember one guy said, "I respect you for that." So it felt good that at least some of them were welcoming and were okay with me sharing.
I want to get back to something else that we talked about in terms of your being willing to complete and make this investment and go forward with your investment, given the uncertainty about your status in the future. You're also encouraging other people to do this. You're talking about, you know, being an outreach coordinator, welcoming people, talking about sharing the dream. But how do you have that conversation? What kinds of conversations do you have? And what do you hear from other people who have your status when you say, look, let's go forward, let's keep pushing forward, and they say, we might not be here in 6 months?
Yeah, a few of them might think that it's pointless. And others, they do agree that they need to share their story. I just think that we should all be able to share our story. And if you can change one person's perspective, then, you know, that's a win for me. Being able to speak out and share who you are, where you come from, you know, and where you're going kind of demonstrates people that, you know, you're not the stereotype that they have in their mind.
You talked about the fact that you were worried about sharing this story because people might judge you. There's a certain sense of shame that you might feel if they judged you. Does that get easier? Does it change your opinion of yourself as you tell your story?
As I tell my story more and more, it does get easier. And for the longest time, I was ashamed of being undocumented. I just didn't feel good enough. I felt like I didn't belong here. But, you know, as I grew to accept it, I made it a part of who I am. And I give credit to that in a point because that has motivated me to do so much in the community and for myself as well.
That should really give us pause. If you think about how well you were doing in school, your plans for yourself, your sense of self-confidence. I'm going to Campbell Law School. I'm going to become a lawyer. No doubt about that. Talking about roommates. That's who you are. And then you realize that there's this piece of paper that you didn't have across this artificial line called a border. And suddenly your whole opinion of you changes.
Yeah, it did change. It's just something that wasn't easy to take. Mm-hmm. But because of that, and I thank God because, you know, he's always been there with me walking every single step of the way, I will still be able to reach my goals. It might just take longer and I won't do it at the same time as my peers, but I will still get there regardless.
Obviously, there's a robust conversation taking place in this country. Sometimes it's taking place on the streets with protests for and against immigrants, for and against minorities. How do you see this conversation unfolding in the United States? Because it does seem to be taking on a very, in some cases, a violent tone and a shrill tone. Is that the way forward, do you think? I mean, and how do you think is this inevitable in this country? We have to have this kind of conversation. And how do you think it might end up?
Well, I think for those who are protesting for DACA, should continue to protest, but I feel like they should change the way that they're doing things. I feel like they're being very aggressive and just saying like hateful things and saying that, you know, Trump is not my president and all that. At the end of the day, whether you like Trump or not, he is our president and that's how it is. Instead, you should be saying, thank you, you know, thank you for allowing us to be here. Thank you for, you know, letting us come here, you know, saying that we love America, because that's the main reason why we're protesting, because we want to stay here. So, yes, they should still let their voice be heard, but, you know, tone it down a little bit and be more friendly about it. And if the people that are protesting against us, you know, just share your story or, you know, pray for them, because that's all you can do.
What are your plans now? We talked about being an immigration lawyer. How do you see yourself as a lawyer? And, you know, sort of give us the picture and what it is that you see for yourself in the future.
So in the future, I want to be able to own my own law firm. I want to be able to help families, you know, from low income, help them find a solution for their immigration problems. Just because, you know, in my situation, I didn't know what to do, whether it may be going to school or, you know, being able to stay here. 9 times out of 10, people don't know how to go about, especially because they have a language issue or they just don't know the customs here. So because I'm bilingual, you know, I want to be able to contribute to their problems and help finding a solution.
Jocelyn, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jocelyn Casanova is a student at Wake Technical Community College and an outreach coordinator at Uniting NC. You can find out more about her story at our website, stateofthings.com. www.talkofeducation.org. And if Talk of Education has inspired you, perhaps you would like to tell us about your favorite school-themed movie. From Clueless to Dead Poets Society, our film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys are going to be talking about their favorite school movies on the next Movies on the Radio. We'd like to hear from you. You can be part of the show. Let us know your pick school films. Email us at sot@stateofthings.org, and you can be part of our next show. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.